You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. For residents of Milwaukee and the surrounding area, recent research into the metro's infrastructure paints a bleak picture. Between a lack of maintenance for roads and the water system to an aging bus fleet, the area has a backlog of projects that could top out at $400 million over the next 4 years. The problem may get worse as time goes on. Our next guest joins us to talk about that research. Rob Henken is the president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you crunched numbers over the last couple of years, really, on everything from roads to sewers to buildings to bridges. Rob, stack up for us for local governments in the Milwaukee area. How big is this burden of infrastructure needs versus what can they afford to pay?
Well, it's pretty big, Rob. I think it's important to distinguish between the three major local governments that we looked at. We looked at Milwaukee County, the city of Milwaukee, and the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District. The good news is, in terms of the sewerage district, the problem isn't bleak at all. They're staying on top of their infrastructure needs. They have a very detailed long-range plan. They have a plan to pay for their needs. The cautionary element there is it's an expensive plan, and it means that property taxpayers are going to have to be able to swallow hard and absorb increases of up to 4% per year. When we look at the city of Milwaukee, we see certainly nothing near crisis stage at this point in time, though we also see signs of an emerging backlog. There's certainly a divergence between what the city can afford to borrow each year and the list of needs for which it ostensibly should be borrowing, and that gap is growing. It's when we look at Milwaukee County that we really see this very, very pressing problem, and that's where the backlog could reach perhaps in excess of $400 million within the next 5 years. And the simple reality is that Milwaukee County has been deferring projects every year for the better part of the last 10 to 15 years because of its fierce financial challenges. That list of backlogged projects is now so big that it's really difficult to see how the county could ever be able to dig its way out of it, both literally and figuratively, without either looking at new revenue sources, taking certain projects off the list, or in all likelihood, a combination of both.
Give us a taste of the kind of projects you're talking about there in Milwaukee County that are big areas of concern.
Well, so there are both some very large projects and dozens upon dozens of smaller projects. So just starting briefly with some of the larger projects, the county has a safety building that is attached to its courthouse complex that houses some very important public safety functions, including district attorney's offices and jails and so forth. That building, quite frankly, has been obsolete for several years, and it has now reached the point that by early in the next decade, the county needs to look at a full replacement, which could cost up to $300 million. We have the Milwaukee County Domes, one of the foremost visitor attractions in the county, that has had all sorts of issues with falling concrete. Plans are still not in place as to whether there's going to be repairs or replacement or even something new, but the price tag there could be in the tens of millions of dollars. We also have the Milwaukee Public Museum that is searching for a new facility. Right now, they're in a county-owned building, and potentially there would be a county cost involved in terms of finding them a new place. So those are some of the big projects, but again, it's in the county parks where there are just dozens upon dozens of deferred projects with regard to paved assets like parkways and walkways and tennis courts and basketball courts, parks pavilions, ball fields, et cetera. And you add all of that up, and it's a very large number.
Well, you talk about solutions in your report on both ends. Let's start on one, the idea of getting rid of some of these facilities. Is that an option on the table?
I think it has to be. And clearly, nobody wants to think about doing that. And, you know, very clearly, if it's the park in your municipality where an asset may have to be relinquished, that's not going to sit very well with you. But the reason that we say that really, in particular, the parks and recreational assets have to be looked at is that those are not mandated by the state of Wisconsin. The county has to take care of its mandated functions first, having to do with public safety and health and human services, for example. So I think there's going to have to be a need to look at that and some real tough questions about whether some of these real big attractions like the domes and like the public museum can still be publicly owned.
And as we wrap up, Rob, on the other side, you mentioned possible new revenue sources. Is there something lurking out there that would be politically possible?
Well, I think that's part of the problem, is that right now, the county and the city, for that matter, their hands are tied because of the revenue structure we've set up. There would need to be state authorization to do anything outside of either the property tax or the wheel tax. So to consider, for example, a temporary local sales tax to try to eat into some of this backlog would require legislative approval in Madison. Whether that is politically feasible, I think, is certainly out of my league to answer. But really, a sales tax of all the other revenue choices would probably make the most sense in terms of the fact that you would be able to charge essentially the consumers of services within these jurisdictions for part of the cost of the infrastructure.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks a lot for having me.
That's Rob Henkin, president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, with us to talk about his group's latest research on infrastructure in the metro Milwaukee area. You can read the Picking Up the Pieces report. It's linked at WPR.org. The Milwaukee area isn't alone when it comes to big questions about infrastructure spending. Cities, states, and the federal government are all dealing with aging roads, bridges, and buildings. Dan McNichol is with us, journalist and writer who covers infrastructure spending and transportation. He's the author of a number of books on the topic, including The Roads That Built America. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thank you, Rob.
Well, you just heard the story in Milwaukee County government in particular there from Rob. Is Milwaukee County alone, or are we seeing this all over the country?
Well, there are about 20,000 incorporated towns in America, and I would say, and I haven't been to all of them, but I've been to a lot of them, and I would say Milwaukee, Wisconsin in particular's issues are a national issue.
How did we get here? How did we end up in a state where we have so much infrastructure that is ready to be repaired or replaced, and we're not financially prepared for it at many levels of government?
That's an excellent question. I think we're the victims of a lot of wealth and a lot of success, and we've built a lot of infrastructure, but we just haven't maintained it. And we're underinvesting. There's devolution going on. When you hear about rural roads and rural bridges being either, as you were talking with Rob earlier about just not building them, tearing them down, not repairing them, you're seeing that in rural areas especially because the cost of maintaining these roads and then even the cost of raising the level of quality of that road is cost prohibitive. And there's a downward trend on building. We are investing a lot less in our infrastructure than we did in the 50s and the 60s when we were building great projects like the interstate highway system. And today, no one wants to pay. No one wants to contribute. I'm being a little facetious, but you have a trend, even in liberal states, whether they're red or blue states or purple states, there's a trend not to invest in our infrastructure.
Dan, I've heard at least from a couple policy people over the years that if you're a politician, building a new road, a new bridge, a new building, that's sexy. Properly funding the 50-year road rotation maintenance plan, not sexy. Is that part of the problem?
Yes, it completely is. There's a wonderful book called Divided Highways, and on the cover of that book, it talks about the interstate highway system. But Tom Lewis's book, it has a wonderful picture in Wisconsin of a ribbon cutting, and it's in the 1950s, and they're opening up a section of, I believe, I-94, and they have misasphalt and misconcrete out there, and their gowns, they have cars and flags and banners and bunting. And it's just a wonderful way to bring a lot of attention to yourself if you're that politician fortunate enough to cut the ribbon on a piece of infrastructure. But you're right. You put money into a sewer. You put money into repairing things. There's no celebration, which I think there probably should be, and there's no recognition for that politician. So sadly, very few politicians lead in this category, and a lot of them are just chasing the next project that they would probably like to put their name on.
Dan, we hear numbers. I want to go to the federal level now. President Trump came into office saying, hey, I'm going to do $1 trillion, and then he met with congressional Democrats, and what number were they throwing out? $4 trillion? I mean, are they just throwing out big numbers, or are they actually inventorying what we need, figuring out what needs to go into it?
Rob, I used to try to get my arms around these numbers, and I have to admit, I've backed away from the numbers because nothing is happening anyway. And with deferred maintenance, those costs multiply so quickly. When you talk about repairing a road that is in good condition, your costs are minimal. When you talk about repairing a road that's gone through several winters where maybe potholes weren't even filled, that's a total rebuild. So it's hard to even chase that number, what is the total that would be needed to be spent to improve our infrastructure. But and I'd like to move beyond anecdotal measures, but I have to tell you, nothing is being done. And what's alarming is that it's taking longer to do what little we are doing. For example, in New York City, the Second Avenue subway, that's a 16-station subway line when it's finished. It took 100 years to get the first three stops built. There are a lot of backstories on that, but the simple fact is that it took 10 years and $5 billion to build three stations on the Upper East Side of New York. Meanwhile, between 2010 and 2015, the Chinese have built a couple thousand miles of subways in their first and second tier cities.
Now, that can get difficult because China might use what we call eminent domain a little more liberally than we're able to in this country. I mean, they can move people out of the way while they fix stuff like this or build stuff like this.
But the reality is, regardless of their government and their ability, their centralized government, their provincial governments, they are building these structures. So you can whine and complain about us having a democracy, a messy democracy. It takes longer. We take care of the environment. That's not all true. We're waylaid with environmental process that is deferring new construction from starting. And when we're finished, we have spent so much money, taken so much time, and delivered so little infrastructure that affects us on the global market. That affects the ability to compete globally. And it doesn't matter what government you have or what the reasons are you're not building. If you're not building, you're losing. And when I say building, I mean I'm assuming that we're building smart systems in our ports, in our rails, in aviation, the grid, on down the line.
We're talking to Dan McNichol about how local, state, and national governments are struggling to maintain infrastructure in the United States, why this could be a bigger and more costly issue down the road. Dan, infrastructure is kind of a distant, abstract word. Do you think in our daily lives we're feeling the impact of not putting enough into fixing stuff, or are we going to be soon?
Well, there are some advantages and disadvantages about obsessing about infrastructure. And I can tell you, I've been watching the word in the media, and it is ballooning. It is now commonplace, and it wasn't 5-10 years ago at all. So I'm encouraged by this. This is a healthy discussion. And when people start focusing on these issues in a messy democracy that is America, which I love, these solutions will bubble up eventually. We tend to obsess, think, debate, and then we finally do the right thing, but only after, I think, too much time has passed.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Gary on the line in Iron River. Gary, hi.
Yes, good evening, or good afternoon, guys. I got a couple comments. One, when we're repairing infrastructure and rebuilding it, we had to do it the most cost-effective way possible, whether it's union jobs or not union jobs. But second, and to me more interesting, is when we were building large amounts of infrastructure using taxes in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, we were spending way less money on other social services and things. And I don't know if that's ever been studied and sort of what percent we're spending now versus then, but we've got ourselves in the problem of more and more and more for government and more and more and more taxes, and eventually that's just too much.
Gary, thanks for your call. Dan, your thoughts?
Yeah, Gary, I think it's an excellent point, and I do agree with you on building whatever we're building. You have to imagine it being like your home. You just want it done well, and you want it to last, and the longer that it lasts, the less it actually costs. And those life cycle costs are really important to look at. But there's no question we're in a much more sophisticated, much more complex society than we were in the 1950s. But there's no excuse for backing away from what we need. And I believe, Gary, that, for example, defense, I think foreign policy begins at home, and I'm following Dwight Eisenhower's actions and his policies, not my own, when I say anything that's good for the country and the economy is good for our national security and our military. And he was talking mostly at that time about roads. And in 1919, he went across the United States in a military convoy, the first military motorized convoy to cross the United States. It took 2 months. They destroyed 88 bridges in just Wyoming. And it really made a point to him, and he mentioned this in his book called At Ease, Stories I Tell to Friends, that this, he wrote a whole chapter about this convoy. And it drove him to build the interstate system because he knew that the economy would greatly benefit. Loss of life on the road would drop significantly, which it did. The interstate system is the safest road in the world. And it spurred development like no one's business. It brought health care and better jobs to areas like the South, the Deep South, that were suffering at the time. And those are the kind of investments that we're not making, that other countries are making, and we continue to sink in world rankings as far as our global competitiveness.
Thanks for the call, Gary. Dan McNichol is with us. He's an author. He writes about transit and infrastructure issues, talking about infrastructure spending in the United States. Back to your calls now. Rob is with us in Wausau. Rob, hello.
Hi. I work in a factory building bridges, and even if we had more money available, there simply isn't the workforce willing to do the work. Like, I work 50 to 70 hours a week. They pay us double time over 50, and for every 10 people that they hire, 9 of them are gone a week later.
Rob, thanks for the call. Rob, seeing a labor shortage in doing this kind of stuff, Dan.
Well, hot economy will do that, and I agree. I this is a dilemma on two fronts. When you have the money and you can build it, how do you get the help? A lot, and very unfortunately, you see more and more outsourcing. We're just not able to do the work that we used to do in this country, especially with metal fabrication. I worked on the Bay Bridge project out in San Francisco, a magnificent rebuild of the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, and the section between Yerba Buena Island and Oakland was rebuilt at about $7 billion. A big chunk of the really magnificent part of that bridge was built in China, where 8,000 or so workers were employed to build the bridge in sections. The sections were lowered into ships, giant hulls. Ships brought them over, unloaded them, and about 160 iron workers in San Francisco, Oakland assembled the pieces. So I think we're going to see a lot more prefabrication like he's speaking of.
Thanks for the call, Rob. Time for another caller. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I think the guest just kind of talked a little bit about what I was going to say, is that one of the things we did in Wisconsin was eliminate the prevailing wage requirement for local projects, but I don't believe we did it for statewide projects. But, you know, we really need to be outsourcing these functions to the best provider, which includes sometimes the best cost or the best value, which impacts cost. And we don't do enough of that, so I'd like to see the cost come down.
Steve, thanks for the call. Are there things that government entities can do to control the cost better, Dan?
Well, you know, I often wonder this, and have spoken to many experts, economists, on the cost of labor, and it's significant. Even Eisenhower kept two sets of records when he was rebuilding his home on Gettysburg, and he wanted to know what it would have cost if he had not used union labor, and his estimate was almost twice. But I bristle a little bit at putting this on the back of labor. I think this is more about what are we spending money on and why aren't we spending more on the areas that we really need to spend more on? For example, fiber optics. You know, as people get more and more concerned and more come to the table about global warming or sea rise or however you want to describe it, there's more and more pressure to not move about, not to burn carbon. And fiber optics could, 5G, we've been hearing a lot about it in the news lately, but the 5G network, it's like electricity was in the 1930s. We need to bring fiber optic high-speed internet into people's homes so they can telecommute, so they can be traveling all around the state and the country or the world if they have to and never leave their home. And that would put a lot less pressure on roads, a lot less pressure on rail, a lot less pressure on airports and traveling, and it would make it for probably a healthier world. But we just haven't done that because the Verizons and the Comcasts of the world are, and understandably, it's not evil, they're just guarding their investments. But if we opened up the internet, like we have with utilities, water, electricity, I think we'd see a remarkable return on investment.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, I've been a real pleasure. I love Wisconsin. Thank you for having me.
That's Dan McNichol, journalist and writer who covers infrastructure spending and transportation. He joined us today to talk about the state of our infrastructure in the United States and challenges facing governments.